one who set things up for your agent to choke to death.
Tell him the best part, the gun says to the mouth.
More and more in my dreams,
the mouth says.
The police have been suspecting you of murdering all the Creedish survivors whose suicides looked fake.
All the Creedish that Adam killed. Those are the ones, the gun says.
The mouth says, the police think maybe you did all the killings to make yourself famous. Overnight, you went from being a fat, ugly house cleaner to being a religious leader, and tomorrow you'll be accused of being the country's most successful serial killer.
The gun says, successful probably isn't the right word. I say, I wasn't all that fat. What did you weigh? The gun says. And be honest. On the wall it says, today is the worst day of the rest of your life. The mouth says,
you were fat. You are fat.
I ask, so why don't you just kill me now? Why don't you put some bullets in your gun and just shoot me? I have bullets loaded, the gun says, and the barrel swivels around to point at my face, my knees, my feet, fertility's mouth. The mouth says,
no, you don't have any bullets.
Yes, I do, the gun says.
Then prove it,
the mouth says.
Shoot him. Right now. Shoot him. Shoot.
I say, don't shoot me. The gun says, I don't feel like it. The mouth says, liar.
Well,
maybe I wanted to shoot him a long time ago, the gun says. But now the more famous he gets, the better. That's why I killed the caseworker and destroyed his mental health records. That's why I've set up the stupid phony bottle of chlorine gas for the agent to sniff. I was only a pretend insane pervert with the caseworker, I say. Scratched on the wall, it says, shit, or get off the pot.
It doesn't matter who kills the agent,
the mouth says.
The police will be right on the 50-yard line to arrest you for mass murder the second you step off camera.
But don't worry, the gun says. We'll be there to rescue you.
Rescue me? Just give them this miracle,
the mouth says.
And there should be a few minutes of chaos so you can get out of the stadium.
I ask, chaos? The gun says, look for us in a car. The mouth says,
a red car.
The gun says,
how do you know? We haven't stolen it yet. I know everything,
the mouth says.
We'll steal a red car with an automatic transmission because I can't drive a stick.
Okay, the gun says, a red car.
Okay,
the mouth says. I couldn't be more not excited. I say, just give me the miracle, and fertility gives me the miracle. The biggest miracle of my career. And she's right. And there will be chaos. There will be complete pandemonium. 16. At 11 o'clock the next morning, the agent is still alive. The agent's alive at 11:10, and at 11:15. The agent's alive at 11:30 and 11:45. At 11:50, the events coordinator chauffeurs me from the hotel to the stadium. With everyone always around us, the coordinators and reps and managers, I can't ask the agent if he's brought a bottle of truth, the fragrance, and when he plans to sniff it next. I can't just tell him not to sniff any cologne today, that it's poison. That the brother I don't have and that I've never seen has got into the agent's luggage and set a trap. Every time I see the agent, every time he disappears into the bathroom or I have to turn my back for a minute, it could be the last time I see him. It's not that I love the agent that much. I can easily enough picture myself at his funeral, what I'd wear, what I'd say in eulogy, giggling. Then I see Fertility and me doing the Argentine tango on his grave. I just don't want to be on trial for mass murder. It's what the caseworker would call an approach-avoidance situation. Whatever I say about cologne, the entourage will repeat to the police if he turns up choked to death. At 4:30, we're backstage at the stadium with the folding tables and catered food and the rented wardrobe, the tuxes and the wedding dress hanging on racks. And the agent is still alive and asking me what I plan to proclaim as my big halftime miracle. I'm not telling.
But is it big?
The agent wants to know.
It's big. It's big enough to make every man in this stadium want to kick my ass.
The agent looks at me, one eyebrow raised, frowning.
The miracle I have is so big, it will take every policeman in this city to keep the crowds from killing me.
I don't tell the agent that. I don't say how that's the idea.
The police will have their hands so full keeping me alive, they won't be able to arrest me for murder.
I don't tell the agent that part.
At 5 o'clock, the agent is still alive, and I'm getting strapped into a white tuxedo with a white bow tie. The justice of the peace comes up and tells me everything is under control. All I have to do is breathe in and out. The bride comes over in her wedding dress, rubbing petroleum jelly up and down her ring finger and says,
"My name's Laura."
This isn't the girl who was in the limo from the day before.
"That was Trisha,"
the bride says. Trisha got sick, so Laura is being her understudy. It's okay. I'll still be married to Trisha even though she's not here. Trisha is the one the agent still wants.
Laura says,
"The cameras won't know."
She's wearing a veil.
People are eating the food brought in by the caterer. Near the steel doors that open onto the sidelines, people from the florist are ready to hustle the altar out onto the football field. The candelabras. The bowers covered with white silk flowers. Roses and peonies and white sweet peas, and stock, all of them brittle and sticky with hairspray to keep them stiff. The armload of silk bouquet for the bride to carry is silk gladioli and white poly-silk dahlias and tulips trailing yards of white silk honeysuckle.
All of it looks beautiful and real if you're far enough away.
The field lights are bright, the makeup artist says, and gives me a huge red mouth. At 6 o'clock, the Super Bowl begins. It's football. It's the Cardinals against the Colts. 5 minutes into the first quarter, it's Colts 6, Cardinals 0. And the agent is still alive. Near the steel doors that open into the stadium are the altar boys and bridesmaids dressed as angels, flirting and smoking cigarettes. With the Colts on their 40-yard line, it's their second down and 6. And the post-event scheduler is briefing me how I'll spend my honeymoon on a 17-city tour to promote the books, the games, the dashboard statuette. Founding my own major world religion isn't out of the picture. A world tour is in the works now that the pesky question about my having sex is covered. The plan includes goodwill tours to Europe, Japan, China, Australia, Singapore, South Africa, Argentina, the British Virgin Islands, and New Guinea, with me getting back to the United States in time to see my first child born. Just so there's nothing left to guesswork, the coordinator tells me the agent has taken certain liberties to make sure my wife will have our first child at the end of my 9-month tour. Long-range planning calls for my wife to have 6, maybe 7 children. A model Creedish family. The events coordinator says I won't have to lift a finger. This will be immaculate conception as far as I'm involved. The field lights are way too bright, the makeup artist says, and smears my cheeks with red. At the end of the first quarter, the agent comes by to make me sign some papers. Profit-sharing documents, the agent tells me. The party known as Tender Branson, to be hereafter known as the victim, grants the party hereafter known as the agent the power to receive and distribute all monies payable to the Tender Branson Media and Merchandising Syndicate, including, but not limited to, book sales, broadcast programming, artwork, live performances, and cosmetics, namely, men's cologne.
"Sign here," the agent says, "and here, here, and here."
Someone is pinning a white rose to my lapel. Someone is on his knees shining my shoes. The makeup artist is still blending. The agent now owns the copyright to my image and my name. It's the end of the first quarter with the game tied 7-7, and the agent still alive. The personal fitness trainer needles me with 10 cc's of adrenaline to put some sparkle in my eyes. The senior events coordinator says all I have to do is walk the 50-yard line out to where the wedding party is standing in the center of the stadium.
The bride will walk in from the opposite side. We'll all of us be standing on a platform of wooden boxes with 5,000 white doves hidden underneath. The audio for the ceremony was all pre-recorded in a studio. So that's what the audience will hear. I don't have to say a word until my prediction. When I step on a switch hidden by my foot, that will release the doves. Walk, talk, doves. It's a cinch. The wardrobe supervisor announces that we need to use the corset to get the silhouette we're after, and tells me to hurry and strip in front of everybody. The angels, the staff, the caterers, the florist people, the agent. Now. Everything except my shorts and socks. Now. The wardrobe supervisor stands with the rubber and wire torture of the corset ready for me to step into, and says, "Here's my last chance to take a leak for the next 3 hours." "You wouldn't have to wear that monster," the agent tells me, "if you could keep the weight off." It's 4 minutes into the second quarter, and nobody can find the wedding ring. The agent blames the events coordinator, blames the wardrobe supervisor, blames the properties manager, blames the jeweler, who was supposed to donate a ring in return for advertising time on the blimp circling the stadium. Outside, the blimp is going around the sky, flashing the jeweler's name. Inside, the agent is threatening to sue for breach of contract and trying to radio the blimp. The events coordinator is telling me, "Fake the ring." They'll have the cameras do a head and shoulders on me and the bride. Just fake putting a ring on Trisha's finger. The bride says she's not Trisha. "And remember," the coordinator says, "just mouth the words. It's all pre-recorded." It's 9 minutes into the second quarter, and the agent is still alive and yelling into his phone. "Shoot it down," he's yelling. "Pull the plug. Give me a gun and I'll do it," he's yelling. "Just get that damn blimp out of the air." "No can do," the events coordinator says. The minute the wedding party comes out of the stadium, the crew in the blimp will dump 15,000 pounds of rice over the parking lot. "If you'll come with me," the senior scheduler says, "it's time for us to take our places." The Colts and Cardinals go chugging off the field, the score 20-17. The crowd is screaming for more football. The Angels and property staff rush out with the altar and silk flowers, the candelabras flaming and the platform full of doves. The corset is squeezing all my internal organs up into my throat. The clock is ticking down to the start of the second half, and the agent is still alive. I can only inhale in little half-breaths. The personal fitness trainer sidesteps up next to me and says, "Here, this will put some color in your cheeks." He puts a little bottle under my nose and says for me to sniff hard. The crowd is stomping their feet. The clock ticks. The score is so close, and I sniff. "Now the other nostril," the trainer says, and I sniff. And everything's disappeared, except for the hum of my blood chugging through veins in my ears and my heart pumping against the squeeze of my corset. I'm not aware of anything. Feel no evil, see no evil, hear no evil, fear no evil. In the distance, the coordinator is waving me out onto the artificial grass. He's pointing down at the line chalked into the field, then pointing out at a group of people standing on the wedding platform covered with white flowers in the center of the field. The hum of my blood is fading until I hear music. I'm walking past the coordinator out into the stadium with the thousands screaming in their seats. The music blares out of nowhere. The blimp circles outside, flashing. Congratulations from the many fine products of the Philip Morris family of products. The bride, Laura, Trisha, whoever, arrives from the opposite side. Without opening his mouth, the Justice of the Peace says, "Do you, tender Branson, take Trisha Connors to be yours, to have and to hold and to be fruitful and multiply with as many times as possible as long as you both shall live?" You can feel the reverb from 100 speakers. Without opening my mouth, I say, "I do." Without opening his mouth, the Justice of the Peace says, "Will you, Tricia Connors, take Tender Branson as long as you both shall live?" And Laura lip-syncs, "I do." With the television camera zooming in, we fake the rings. We fake the kiss. The veil stays pretty much in place. Laura stays Tricia. From a distance, everything looks perfect. Outside the shot, the police are starting out onto the field. The agent must be dead. The cologne. Chlorine gas. The police are at the 10-yard line. I ask the Justice of the Peace for a microphone to make my big prediction, my miracle. The police are at the 20-yard line. I get the microphone, but it's dead. The police are at the 25-yard line. I say testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. The police are at the 30-yard line, their handcuffs open and ready to snap on me. The microphone comes to life, and my voice blares from the sound system. The police are at the 40-yard line saying, "You have the right to remain silent. If you choose to give up that right, anything you say can and will be used against you." And I give up my right. I give my prediction. The police are at the 45-yard line. My voice blaring throughout the stadium, I say, "The final score of today's game will be Colts 27, Cardinals 24. The Colts will win today's Super Bowl by 3 points, and all hell breaks loose." What's worse than that? Engine number 2 has just flamed out. Up here alone in Flight 2039, I only have 2 engines left. 15. To do the job right, you take 1 sheet of goldenrod paper and fold it around a sheet of white paper. Slip a coupon inside the folded papers. Hold a sheet of merchandise stamps alongside the folded papers. Then fold a sheet of the letterhead paper around all of it, and stuff this into an envelope. Stick the corresponding address label on the envelope, and you've earned 3 cents. Do this 33 times, and you've earned almost a dollar. Where we're at tonight is Adam Branson's idea. The letter I'm folding starts, "Is the water that comes into the Wilson house bringing with it dangerous parasites?" Where we're at is supposed to be safe. The goldenrod around the white, the coupon inside, the sheet of stamps, the letterhead paper, it all goes inside the envelope, and I'm 3 cents closer to escaped. Is the water that comes into the Cameron house bringing with it dangerous parasites? The 3 of us sit around the dining room table, Adam and Fertility and me, stuffing these envelopes. At 10 o'clock, the house mother locks the front door of the house and stops on her walk back to the kitchen to ask if our daughter is doing any better. Have the doctors upgraded her condition? Will she live? Fertility, with rice still in her hair, says, "We're not out of the woods. Not yet." Of course, we don't have a daughter. Us having a daughter was Adam Branson's idea. Around us is the combination of 3 or 4 families, kids and parents, talking about cancer and chemotherapy, burns and skin grafts, staph infections. The house mother asks what we call our little girl. Adam and Fertility and I look at each other, Fertility with her tongue stuck out to lick an envelope flap. Me looking at Adam is the same as looking at a picture of who I used to be. Altogether, we say 3 different names. Fertility says, "Amanda." Adam says, "Patty." I say, "Laura." Only the 3 names all overlap. Our daughter. The house mother looks at me in the burned-up remains of my white tuxedo and asks, "Why is our little daughter in the hospital for treatment?" Altogether, we say 3 different problems. Fertility says, "Scoliosis." Adam says, "Polio." I say, "Tuberculosis." The house mother watches us folding, the yellow and the white, the coupon, the stamps, the letterhead. Her eyes come back to the handcuffs snapped around one of my wrists. "Is the water that comes into the Dixon house bringing with it dangerous parasites?" "It was Adam who brought us here. Just for one night," he says. "It's safe here." Now that I'm a mass murderer, Adam knows how we can start north in the morning. North, until we get to Canada. But for tonight, we needed a place to hide. We needed food. We needed to earn a little cash. So he brought us here. This is after the stadium and after the crowds were tearing to shreds the line of police crowd control. This is right after my sham marriage, when the agent was dead and the police were fighting to keep me alive so they could execute me for murder. The contents of the entire Superdome emptied down onto the field the minute I announced the Colts would win. One half of the handcuffs already clicked around my one wrist. The police were nothing against the running tide of drunks that rolled toward us from the sidelines. The band was somewhere playing the national anthem. Out of every direction, people are dropping onto the field from the bottom of the stands. People are running with their hands and fists out across the grass toward us. There are the Arizona Cardinals in their uniforms. There are the Indianapolis Colts still at their bench, slapping ass and giving each other high fives. The moment the police get to the edge of the wedding platform, I kick the switch and 5,000 white doves fly up in a solid wall around me. The doves drive the police back long enough for the football mob to reach center field. The police fight back the mob, and I grab the bride's bouquet. Sitting here, stuffing envelopes, I want to tell everybody how I made my great escape. How the crowd control cylinders of tear gas jet trailed back and forth overhead. How the crowd roar echoed under the dome. How I grabbed the poly-silk white armload of silk flowers from the bride, tears streaming down her face. How I just touched the hairsprayed bouquet to a burning candle, and I had a torch to hold back any attacker. Holding the torch of gladioli and whipping hot wires of fake honeysuckle out in front of me, I jumped off the wedding platform and fought my way down the football field, the 50-yard line. The 40-yard line. The 30. Me, in my white tuxedo, I dodged and quarterbacked my way, sprinting and pivoting. The 20-yard line. To keep from being tackled, I whipped the burning dahlias side to side in front of me. The 10-yard line. 10,000 tackles are out to sack me. Some of them drunk, some of them professionals. None of them are jacked on the quality chemicals I'm riding. Hands grab at my white tails. Men dive for my legs. It's the steroids that saved my life. Then, touchdown. I cross under the goalpost, still headed for the steel doors that will get me off the field. My torch is burned down to just some tiny silk trilliums when I toss it back over my shoulder. I jam through the steel double doors and turn the deadbolt from the other side. With the Super Bowl crowd pounding the locked doors, I'm safe here for a few minutes alone with the catered food and the makeup artist. The agent's dead body is under a white sheet on a gurney next to the buffet. The buffet is mostly just turkey sandwiches and bottled water, fresh fruit, pasta salad, wedding cake. The makeup artist is eating a sandwich. She cocks her head sideways at the dead agent and says, "Good job," she says. She always hated him, too. She's wearing the agent's heavy gold Rolex. The makeup artist says, "You want a sandwich?" I ask, "Is it just turkey, or do they have another kind?" The makeup artist hands me a bottle of mineral water and says my tuxedo is on fire in the back. I ask, "Where's the outside?" "Take that door over there," the makeup artist says. The steel doors behind me are buckling in their frame. "Go down the long hall," the makeup artist says. "Turn right at the end. Go out the door marked exit." I say thanks. She says there's a meatloaf sandwich left if I want it. The sandwich in my one hand, I go out the door she said. Go down the hall. Go out the exit. Outside in the parking lot is a red car. A red car with an automatic transmission. Fertility behind the wheel and Adam sitting next to her. I get in the back seat and lock the door. To Fertility in the front seat, I tell her to roll up her window. Fertility fiddles with the controls for the radio. Behind me, the crowd is pouring out the exits, running to surround us. Their faces are getting close enough for me to feel spit on. Then, out of the sky comes the biggest miracle. It starts raining. A rain of white. Manna from heaven, I swear. A rain comes down so slick and heavy, the mob is falling, slipping and falling, fallen and sprawled. White bits of rain bounce in the car windows, into the carpet, into our hair. Adam looks out in wonder at the miracle of this white rain that's helping us get away. Adam says,
"It's a miracle."
The back wheels spin, skid sideways, and then leave black as we escape.
"No,"
Fertility says, and hits the gas.
"It's rice."
The blimp circling the stadium says congratulations and happy honeymoon.
"I wish they wouldn't do that," Fertility says. "That rice kills birds."
I tell her that rice that kills birds saved our lives. We were on the street, then we were on a freeway. Adam twisted around in the front seat to ask me,
"Are you going to eat all that sandwich?"
I say, "It's meatloaf." "We needed a ride north," Adam said. He knew about a ride, but it wasn't leaving New Orleans until the next morning. He had almost 10 years of doing this, traveling back and forth across the country with no money in secret. "Killing people," I say.
"Delivering people to God," he says.
Fertility says,
"Shut up."
"We need some cash," Adam tells us. "We need some sleep, food." And he knew where we could find some. He knew a place where people would have bigger problems than we did. We only had to lie a little.
"From now on," Adam tells us, "you two have a child."
"We do not."
"Your child is deathly ill,"
Adam says. "Our child is not."
"You're in New Orleans, so your child can go to a hospital,"
Adam says.
"That's all you need to say."
Adam says he'll handle the rest. Adam tells Fertility,
"Turn here."
He says,
"Now turn right here."
He says,
"Go up 2 more blocks and turn left."
Where he's taking us, we can stay overnight for free. We can get food donated for us to eat. We can do peace work, collating documents or stuffing envelopes to earn a little cash. We can get showered, watch ourselves on television making our escape on the evening news. Adam tells me I'm too much of a mess to be recognized as an escaped mass murderer who ruined the Super Bowl. Where we're going, he says, people will have their own big problems to worry about. Fertility says,
"Like, how many people do you have to kill to make the jump from serial killer to mass murderer?"
Adam tells us, "Sit tight in the car, and I'll go inside to grease the skids. Just remember, your child is very sick." Then he says,
"We're here."
Fertility looks at the house and at Adam and says,
"You're the one who's very sick."
Adam says,
"I'm your poor child's godfather."
The sign in the front yard says, "Ronald McDonald House." 14. Imagine you live in a house, only every day your house is in a different town. Only every day your house is in a different town. We had 3 ways out of New Orleans Adam knew about. Adam took Fertility and me to a truck stop on the edge of the city and said to take our pick. The airports were being watched. The train and bus stations were staked out. We couldn't all 3 of us hitchhike, and Fertility refused to drive all the way to Canada.
"I flat out don't like driving," Fertility says.
"Besides, your brother's way to travel is just a lot more fun."
The day after the Ronald McDonald House, we are the 3 of us standing in the acres of gravel parking lot outside a truck stop cafe when Adam pulls a linoleum knife out of his back pocket and slips the blade open.
"What will it be, people?"
he says. "Nothing here is going due north." Adam's been inside talking up all the truck drivers. "What we have to choose from is the following," Adam says, pointing at each. "There's a Westbury estate going west on Highway 10 to Houston. There's a plantation manor headed northeast on Highway 55 to Jackson. There's a Spring Hill castle going northwest to Bosser City on Highway 49, with stops at Alexandria and Pineville, then headed west on Highway 20 to Dallas. Parked around us on the gravel are prefabricated houses, manufactured houses, trailer houses. These are broken into halves or thirds and hooked to the back of semi-trucks. The open side of each modular piece is sealed with a sheet of translucent plastic, and inside are the murky shapes of sofas, beds, rolls of rolled-up carpet, major appliances, dining room sets, easy chairs. While Adam was chatting with the drivers, finding out where each is headed, Fertility was in the truck stop bathroom dyeing my blonde hair black in the sink and washing the tanning bronzer off my face and hands. We stuffed enough envelopes to buy me thrift store clothes and get a paper bag of fried chicken with paper napkins and coleslaw. The three of us standing in the parking lot, Adam waves his knife in a circle and says, "Choose. The men who deliver these lovely homes won't be eating their dinners all night. Most long-haul truck drivers drive at night," Adam tells us. "There's less traffic. It's cooler. During the hot, busy day, the drivers pull off the highway and sleep in the sleeper boxes attached to the back of each truck cab." Fertility asks, "What's the difference what we choose?" "The difference," Adam says, "is your comfort level." This is how Adam's been crossing and crisscrossing the country for the past 10 years. A Westbury estate has a formal dining room and a built-in fireplace in the living room. The plantation manor has walk-in closets and a breakfast nook. The Spring Hill Castle has a whirlpool bathtub and the glamour bath. A glamour bath has two sinks and a wall of mirror. The living room and the master bedroom have skylights. The dining nook has a built-in china hutch with leaded glass doors. This is depending on which half you get. Again, these are just parts of homes. Broken homes. Dysfunctional homes. The half you get might be all bedrooms. Or just a kitchen and living room and no bedrooms. There might be three bathrooms and nothing else, or you might get no bathroom at all. None of the lights work. All the plumbing is dry. No matter how many luxuries you get, something will be missing. No matter how carefully you choose, you'll never be totally happy. We choose the Spring Hill Castle, and Adam slices the knife along the bottom edge of the plastic ceiling its open side. Adam slices only about 2 feet, only far enough for his head and shoulders to slip inside. Stale air from inside the house comes out the slice hot and dry. With Adam slid inside as far as his waist, his butt and legs still outside with us, Adam says, "This one has the cornflower blue interior." His voice, coming from inside the wall of translucent plastic, he says, "Here we have the premium furniture package, a modular living room pit group, built-in microwave in the kitchen, plexiglass dining room chandelier." Adam boosts all of himself inside. Then his blonde head sticks out the slice in the plastic and grins at us. "California king-size beds, faux wood grain countertops, low-line Euro-style commode, and vertical blind window treatments." He says, "You've made an excellent choice for your starter home." First, Fertility and then me slide through the plastic. The way the inside of the house, the furniture shapes and the colors, look blurred and vague from outside, that's how the outside world, the real world, looks out of focus and unreal from inside the plastic. The neon lights of the truck stop are just coming on, dim and smeared outside the plastic. The noise of the highway sounds soft and muffled from inside. Adam kneels down with a roll of clear strapping tape and seals the slice he made from the inside. "We won't need this anymore," he says. "When we get where we're going, we'll just walk out the front or the back door just like real people." The wall-to-wall carpet is rolled up against one wall, awaiting the rest of the house before it's installed. The furniture and mattresses stand around covered with dry-cleaning plastic thin dust covers. The kitchen cabinets are each taped shut. Fertility tries the light switch for the dining room chandelier. Nothing happens. "Don't use the toilet either," Adam says, "or we'll be living with your business until we move out." Neon from the truck stop and headlights from the highway flicker through the dining room French doors while we sit around the maple veneer table eating our fried chicken. This part of our broken home has one bedroom, the living room, kitchen, and dining room, and half a bath. If we get all the way to Dallas, Adam tells us, we can move into a house headed up Interstate 35 to Oklahoma. Then we can catch houses up Interstate 35 to Kansas. Then north on Interstate 135 in Kansas to westbound Interstate 70 to Denver. In Colorado, we'll catch a house going northeast on Interstate 76 until it turns into Interstate 80 in Nebraska. Nebraska? Adam looks at me and says, yeah. Our old stomping grounds, yours and mine, he says with his mouth full of chewed-up fried chicken. Why Nebraska? To get to Canada, Adam says, and looks at Fertility, who looks at her food. We'll follow Interstate 80 to Interstate 29 across the state line in Iowa. Then we just cruise north up 29 through South Dakota and North Dakota, all the way to Canada. Right straight to Canada, Fertility says, and gives me a smile that looks fake because Fertility never smiles. When we say goodnight, Fertility takes the mattress in the bedroom. Adam falls asleep on one length of the blue velvet sectional pit group. Pillowed in the blue velvet, he looks dead in a casket. For a long time, I lay awake on the other length of the sectional and wonder about the lives I left behind. Fertility's brother Trevor, the caseworker, the agent, my all-dead family. Almost all dead. Adam snores, and a nearby diesel truck engine rumbles to life. I wonder about Canada, if running is going to resolve anything. Lying here, in the cornflower blue darkness, I wonder if running is just another fix, to a 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 problem I can't remember. The whole house shudders. The chandelier swings. The leaves of the silk ferns in their wicker baskets vibrate. The window treatments sway, quiet. Outside the plastic, the world starts moving, sliding by, faster and faster until it's erased, until I fall asleep. 13. Our second day on the road, my teeth feel dull and yellow. My muscles feel less toned. I can't live my life as a brunette. I need some time, just a minute, just 30 seconds under a spotlight. No matter how much I try and hide this, bit by bit, I start to fall apart. We're in Dallas, Texas, considering half a Wilmington villa with faux tile countertops and a bidet in the master bath. It has no master bedroom, but it has a laundry room with washer-dryer hookups. Of course, it has no water or power or phone. It has almond-colored appliances in the kitchen. There isn't a fireplace, but the dining room has floor-length drapes. This is after we look at more houses than I can remember. Houses with gas fireplaces. Houses with French provincial furniture. Vast glass-topped coffee tables. And track lighting. This is with the sunset red and gold on the flat Texas horizon in a truck stop parking lot outside Dallas proper. I wanted to go with a house that had separate bedrooms for each of us, but no kitchen. Adam wanted the house that had only two bedrooms, a kitchen, but no bathroom. Our time was almost up. The sun was almost down, and the drivers were about to start their all-night drives. My skin felt cold and rolling with sweat. All of me, even the blonde roots of my hair, ached. Right there in the gravel, I just started doing push-ups in the middle of the parking lot. I rolled onto my back and started doing stomach crunches with the intensity of convulsions. The subcutaneous fat was already building up. My abdominal muscles were disappearing. My pecs were starting to sag. I needed bronzer. I needed to log some time in a sunbed. Just 5 minutes, I beg Adam and Fertility. Before we hit the road again, just give me 10 minutes in a wolf tanning bed. No can do, little brother, Adam says. The FBI will be watching every gym and every tanning salon and health food store in the Midwest. After just 2 days, I was sick of the crap deep-fried food they serve at truck stops. I wanted celery. I wanted mung beans. I wanted fiber and oat bran and brown rice and diuretics. What I told you about? Fertility says, looking at Adam. It's starting. We need to get him locked up someplace, stat. He's going into attention withdrawal syndrome. The two of them hustle me into a maison d'élégance, just as the driver was putting his truck in gear. They pushed me into a back bedroom with just a bare mattress and a giant Mediterranean dresser with a big mirror above it. Outside the bedroom door, I could hear them piling Mediterranean furniture, sofa groups, and end tables, lamps made to look like old wine bottles, entertainment centers, and bar stools against the outside of the bedroom door. Texas is speeding past the bedroom window outside. In the twilight, a sign goes by the window saying, Oklahoma City, 250 miles. The whole room shakes. The walls are papered with tiny yellow flowers, vibrating so fast they make me travel sick. Anywhere I go in this bedroom, I can still see myself in the mirror. My skin is going regular white without the ultraviolet light I need. Maybe it's just my imagination, but one of my caps feels loose. I try not to panic. I tear off my shirt and study myself for damage. I stand sideways and suck in my stomach. I could really use a preloaded syringe of Durotestin right about now. Or Anavar. Or Decadurabolin. My new hair color makes me look washed out. My last eyelid surgery didn't take, and already my eye bags show. My hair plugs feel loose. I turn to study myself in the mirror for any hair growing on my back. A sign goes by the window saying, soft shoulders. The last of my bronzer is caked in the corners of my eyes and the wrinkles around my mouth and across my forehead. I try and nap. I pick apart the mattress ticking with my fingernails. A sign goes by the window saying, slower traffic, keep right. There's a knock at the door. I have a cheeseburger if you want it, Fertility says through the door and all the piled-up furniture. I don't want a greasy, damned, fatty, damned cheeseburger, I yell back. You need to eat sugar and fat and salt until you get back to normal, Fertility says. This is for your own good. I need a full body wax, I yell. I need hair mousse. I'm pounding on the door. I need 2 hours in a good weight room. I need to go 300 stories on a stair-climbing machine. Fertility says, You just need an intervention. You're going to be fine. She's killing me. We're saving your life. I'm retaining water. I'm losing definition in my shoulders. My eye bags need concealer. My teeth are shifting. I need my wires tightened. I need my dietitian. Call my orthodontist. My calves are wasting away. I'll give you anything you want. I'll give you money. Fertility says, You don't have money. I'm famous. You're wanted for mass murder. Her and Adam have to get me some diuretics. Next time we stop, Fertility says, I'll get you a skinny double Americano. That's not enough. It's more than you'd get in prison. Let's rethink this, I say. In prison, I'd have weight equipment. I'd have time in the sun. They must have sit-up boards in prison. I could maybe get black market Winsterol. I say, just let me out. Just unblock this door. Not until you're making sense. I want to go to prison. In prison, they'll have the electric chair. I'll take that risk. But they might kill you. Good enough. I just need to be the center of a lot of attention. Just one more time. Oh, you go to prison, and you'll be the center of attention. I need moisturizer. I need to be photographed. I'm not like regular people. To survive, I need to be constantly interviewed. I need to be in my natural habitat. On television. I need to run free, signing books. I'm leaving you alone for a while, Fertility says through the door. You need a time out. I hate being mortal. Think of this as My Fair Lady or Pygmalion, only backward. 12. The next time I wake up, I'm delirious, and Fertility is sitting on the edge of my bed massaging cheap petroleum-based moisturizer into my chest and arms. Welcome back, she says. We almost thought you weren't going to make it. Where am I? Fertility looks around. You're in a Maplewood chateau with the mid-range interior package, she says. Seamless linoleum in the kitchen, no wax vinyl floor covering in the 2 bathrooms. It's got easy clean pattern vinyl wallboard instead of sheetrock, and this one's decorated in the blue and green seaside theme. No, I whisper. Where in the world? Fertility says, I knew that's what you meant. A sign goes by the window saying, Detour ahead. The room around us is different than I remember. A wallpaper border of dancing elephants goes around next to the ceiling. The bed I'm in has a canopy and white machine-made lace curtains hanging around it and tied back with pink satin ribbons. White louvered shutters flank the windows. The reflection of fertility in me is framed in a heart-shaped mirror on the wall. I ask, what happened to the Maison?
That was 2 houses ago,
fertility says.
We're in Kansas now, in half a 4-bedroom maplewood chateau. It's the top of the line in manufactured houses.
So it's really nice?
Adam says it's the best,
she says, smoothing the covers over me.
It comes with color-coordinated bed linens, and there are dishes in the dining room cabinets that match the mauve of the velvet sofa and loveseat in the living room. There's even color-coordinated mauve towels in the bathroom. There's no kitchen, though, at least not in this half. But I'm sure wherever it's at, the kitchen is mauve.
I ask, where's Adam?
Sleeping.
He wasn't worried about me.
I told him how this was all going to work out,
fertility says.
Actually, he's very happy.
The bed curtains dance and swing with the movement of the house. A sign goes by the window saying, caution. I hate that fertility knows everything. Fertility says,
I know that you hate that I know everything.
I ask if she knows I killed her brother. As easy as that, the truth comes out. My whole deathbed confession.
I know you talked to him the night he died, she says, but Trevor killed himself.
And I wasn't his homosexual lover.
I knew that too.
And I was the voice on the crisis hotline she talked dirty to.
I know.
She rubs a handful of moisturizer between her palms and then smooths it into my shoulders.
Trevor called your fake crisis hotline because he was looking for a surprise. I've been after you for the same thing.
With my eyes closed, I ask if she knows how this will all turn out.
Long-term or short-term?
She asks. Both.
Long-term?
She says.
We're all going to die. Then our bodies will rot. No surprise there. Short-term, we're going to live happily ever after.
Really?
Really,
she says.
So don't sweat it.
I look at myself getting older in the heart-shaped mirror. A sign goes by the window saying, drive to stay alive. A sign goes by the window saying, speed checked by radar. A sign goes by the window saying, lights on for safety. Fertility says,
can you relax and let things happen?
I ask, does she mean like disasters? Like pain? Like misery? Can I just let all that happen?
And joy,
she says.
And serenity, and happiness, and contentment.
She says, all the wings of the Columbia Memorial Mausoleum.
You don't have to control everything, she says.
You can't control everything. But you can be ready for disaster. A sign goes by saying, buckle up.
If you worry about disaster all the time, that's what you're going to get, fertility says.
A sign goes by saying, watch out for falling rocks. A sign goes by saying, dangerous curves ahead. A sign goes by saying, slippery when wet. Outside the window, Nebraska is getting closer by the minute. The whole world is a disaster waiting to happen.
I want you to know, I won't always be here, fertility says, but I'll always find you.
A sign goes by the window saying, Oklahoma, 25 miles.
No matter what happens, fertility says, no matter what you do or your brother does, it's the right thing.
She says, you have to trust me. I ask, can I just have some chapstick? For my lips. They're chapped. A sign goes by saying, yield.
Okay, she says. I've forgiven your sins. If it helps you relax a little, I guess I can get you some chapstick.
11. Of course, we lose fertility at a truck stop outside Denver, Colorado. Even I could see that coming. She sneaks off to get me some chapstick while the truck driver is out taking a leak. Adam and me are both asleep until we hear her screaming. And of course, she planned it this way. In the dark, in the moonlight through the windows, I stumble through the furniture to where Adam has thrown open the 2 front doors. We're pulling away from the truck stop, gaining speed as the driver upshifts with fertility running after us. her one hand outstretched with the little tube of chapstick. Her red hair is flagging out behind her. Her shoes slap the pavement. Adam is stretching his one hand out to save her. His other hand is gripping the door frame. With the shaking of the house, a marble-topped little occasional table falls over and rolls past Adam out the doors. Fertility dodges as the table smashes in the street. Adam is saying, "Take my hand! You can reach it!" A dining room chair shakes out of the house and smashes, almost hitting Fertility, and she says, "No!" Her words almost lost in the roar of the truck engine. She says, "Take the chapstick!" Adam says, "No! If I can't reach you, we'll jump! We have to stay together!" "No!" Fertility says, "Take the chapstick! He needs it!" Adam says, "He needs you more!" The windows we left open suck air inside, and the easy living open floor plan channels this airstream out through the front doors. Embroidered throw pillows blow off the sofa and bounce out the front doors around Adam. They fly at Fertility, hitting her in the face and almost tripping her. Framed decorative art, botanical print reproductions mostly, and tasteful racehorse prints flap off the walls and sail out to explode into shards of glass and wood slivers and art. The way I feel, I want to help, but I'm weak. I've lost too much attention in the last few days. I can hardly stand. My blood sugar levels are all over the map. I can only watch as Fertility falls behind, and Adam risks leaning out farther and farther. The silk flower arrangements topple, and red silk roses, red silk geraniums, and blue iris sail out the door and flutter around Fertility. The symbols of forgetfulness, poppies, land in the road, and she sprints over them. The wind throws mock orange and sweet peas, white and pink, baby's breath and orchids, white and purple, at Fertility's feet. "Don't jump!" Fertility is saying. She's saying, "I'll find you! I know where you're going!" For one instant, she almost makes it. Fertility almost reaches Adam's hand, but when he makes his grab to pull her inside, their hands miss. Almost miss. Adam opens his hand, and inside is the tube of chapstick, and Fertility has fallen back into the dark and the past behind us. Fertility is gone. We must be going 60 miles an hour by now, and Adam turns and throws the tube at me so hard it ricochets off two walls. Adam snarls, "I hope you're happy now. I hope your lips recover." The dining room china cabinet comes open and dishes, salad plates, soup tureens, dinner plates, stemware, and cups bounce and roll out the front doors. All this smashes in the street. All this leaves a wide trail behind us, sparkling in the moonlight. Nobody is running behind us, and Adam wrestles a console color television with surround sound and near digital picture quality toward the door. With a shout, he shoves it off the front porch. Then he shoves a velvet love seat off the porch. Then the spinet piano. Everything explodes when it hits the road. Then he looks at me. Stupid, weak, desperate me. I'm groveling on the floor trying to find the chapstick. His teeth bared, his hair hanging in his face, Adam says, "I should throw you out that door." Then a sign goes by saying, "Nebraska, 98 miles. And a smile, slow and creepy, cuts across Adam's face. He staggers to the open front doors, and with the night wind howling around him, he shouts, "Fertility Hollis!" He shouts, "Thank you!" He shouts. Into the darkness behind us, all the darkness and scraps and glass and wreckage behind us, Adam shouts, "I won't forget everything you told me must happen!" 10. The night before we get home, I tell my big brother everything I can remember about the Cretish Church District. In the church district, we raised everything we ate, the wheat and eggs and the sheep and cattle. I remember we tended perfect orchards and caught sparkling rainbow trout in the river. We're on the back porch of a Casa Castile going 60 miles an hour through the Nebraska night down Interstate 80. A Casa Castile, has cut glass sconces on every wall and gold-plated fixtures in the bathroom, but no power or water. Everything is beautiful, but none of it works. No electricity and no running water, Adam says. It's just like when we were kids. We're sitting on the back porch with our legs hanging over the edge and the pavement rushing under. The stinking diesel exhaust from the truck eddies around us. In the Kredish Church District, I tell Adam, people lived simple, fulfilled lives. We were a steadfast and proud people. Our air and water were clean. Our days were useful. Our nights were absolute. That's what I remember. That's why I don't want to go back. Nothing will be there except the tender Branson sensitive material sanitary landfill. How it will look, the stored-up years of pornography from all over the country sent here to rot, I don't want to see firsthand. The agent showed me the receipts. Tons of smut, dump trucks and hoppers full, garbage trucks and boxcars full of smut were arriving there every month, where bulldozers spread it 3 feet deep across all 20,000 acres. I don't want to see that. I don't want Adam to see that, but Adam still has his gun, and I don't have fertility here to tell me if it's loaded or not. Besides, I'm pretty used to getting told what to do, where to go, how to act. My new job is to follow Adam. So we're going back to the church district. In Grand Island, we'll steal a car, Adam says. We'll get to the valley just around sunrise, Adam predicts. It's just a matter of hours. We'll be getting home on a Sunday morning. Both of us looking out into the dark behind us and everything we've lost so far, Adam says. What else do you remember? Everything in the church district was always clean. The roads were always in good repair. The summers were long and mild with rain every 10 days. I remember the winters were peaceful and serene. I remember sorting seed we picked from marigolds and sunflowers. I remember splitting wood. Adam asks, do you remember my wife? Not really. She wasn't much to remember, Adam says. The gun's in his hands on his lap or I wouldn't be sitting here. She was a Biddy Gleason. We should have been very happy together. Until someone called the government and started the investigation. We should have bred a dozen children and made money hand over fist, Adam said. Until the county sheriff was there asking about documentation for every child. We should have gotten old on that farm with every year just like the year before it. Until the FBI launched its investigation. We should both have been church elders someday, Adam says. Until the deliverance. Until the deliverance. I remember life was calm and peaceful in the district valley. The cows and chickens all running free. The laundry hanging outside to dry. The smell of hay in the barn. Apple pies cooling on every windowsill. I remember it was a perfect way of life. Adam looks at me and shakes his head. He says, that's how stupid you are. How Adam looks in the dark is how I'd look if none of this chaos had ever happened to me. Adam is what fertility would call a control group of me. If I'd never been baptized and sent into the outside world, if I'd never been famous and blown out of proportion, that would be me with Adam's simple blue eyes and clean blonde hair. My shoulders would be squared and regular-sized. My manicured hands with clear polish on the nails would be his strong hands. My chapped lips would be like his. My back would be straight. My heart would be his heart. Adam looks out into the dark and says, I destroyed them. The Kredish survivors. No, Adam says. All of them. The entire district colony. I called the police. I left the valley one night and walked until I found a telephone. There were birds in every Kredish tree, I remember, and we caught crawdads by tying a lump of bacon fat to a string and dropping it into the creek. When we pulled it out, the fat would be covered with crawdads. I must have pressed zero.